For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. For more information, visit faith.yale.edu. This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Hello, friends and listeners. Thanks for tuning into the show. This week, in light of the tension and much needed perspective, we're turning to some of the more significant points of relevance from some of our past episodes pertaining to faith and politics. We've got plenty more fresh conversations and reflections and interviews coming your way in 2021, but this week just seemed to catch all of us. So if you haven't yet heard Miroslav Volf deliver our joint statement from the staff of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture on sedition at the Capitol, then check out that 10-minute episode as well. As we've searched for words to understand, words to grieve the violence and division and death, words to evaluate, critique, and condemn, and words to forgive, to heal, to unite what seems ununifiable, the words often just come up empty, lacking, half-hearted. It's reminiscent of the piercing words of the prophet Jeremiah, a hot take if there ever was one, as he condemns those who have, quote, treated the wound of my people carelessly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. They acted shamefully. They committed abomination, yet they were not ashamed. They did not know how to blush. Jeremiah goes on, thus says the Lord, stand at the crossroads and look and ask for the ancient paths, where the good way lies, and walk in it and find rest for your souls. As we walk together, seeking where the good way lies, these ancient paths, trod by so many before us, let's not give up on a hope against hope, a hope for things that we most certainly now do not see. There is no peace, but we need to envision it. We must be the instruments of that peace. So to that end, here's the breakdown of our episode today. It's really a kind of best of for faith and politics in America. Theologian Willie Jennings on crowds, mobs, fear, and anger. Sociologists Samuel Perry and Andrew Whitehead on Christian nationalism, identity, and violence. Novelist Marilyn Robinson on Christianity and democracy. Political commentator David French on political exhaustion, culture war, and the role of faith in political division. Legal scholar Robert George on the breakdown of civic friendship. And we close with sociologist Arlie Hochschild on building shelters from shame and crossing a bridge to empathy. If any of these particular sections interest you, you can check the show notes for the time codes where you can jump ahead and listen. Thanks for listening, and peace to you all. This is theologian Willie Jennings on crowds, mobs, fear, and anger.
In your commentary on this passage, you write, the crowd is always susceptible to the fear that clothes the creature. The crowd is the creature exposed in its vulnerability. So nationalistic slogan, religious incantation, or enthusiastic cheering are used to conceal this vulnerability. The volume of a crowd is never an indication of the strength of their faith, but always their vulnerability and oftentimes their fear. The crowd needs faith. A crowd that gains faith shrinks in size and becomes a congregation. That's wonderful. Could you say a little bit more about what you meant here?
Crowds are places of profound fear or places that are profoundly susceptible to fear. Oftentimes, we imagine crowds as a sign of strength, to gather a large crowd, to be able to manipulate a large crowd, all imagined inside of a certain kind of strength. But what crowds also show us is not so much strength. They show us the vulnerability in the number, in the multitude. And so fear is often what rides in the undercurrents of a crowd. And wanting to hide from fear oftentimes drives the crowd. The congregation, in distinction, is a crowd, if you will, that has been disciplined, shrunk in size by the reality of faith. And it is a group of people who, because of their faith, they understand that the fear that drives the crowd is not what drives them. Of course, you can have a congregation that still longs to be a crowd, and a congregation that, in that sense, is susceptible to returning to the reality of the crowd. A congregation that loses sight of its own faith, it loses sight of what holds it together and what draws it together, rather than the reality of fear and how one responds to fear. The interesting thing about that passage is that that crowd, it imagines rightly the possibilities of loss because of these disciples of Jesus. That they have been told that their livelihoods are at stake by the very presence of these disciples. And in a sense, they rightly see a possibility. The problem is that they don't see enough. What they see is the possibility of loss. They can't see beyond that possibility, that the possibility of something new, a new way of life that might allow them to imagine a future beyond the fear of loss.
Willie Jennings came back on the show in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in May to share these reflections on hope and shareable anger.
Hope is a discipline. It is not a sentiment. But what I have also learned is that living the discipline of hope in this racial world, in this white supremacist infested country called the United States of America, requires anger. I am angry. As long as I can remember, I have sensed this anger in me like a constant low humming sound, sounding from my very being. In truth, there is something quite noble in being the proverbial angry Black person. Of course, it is not a proverb. This anger is the result of a history that will not relent, a history that constantly seeks to bind Black people to death itself. But I've also come to realize that this anger, my anger, is connected to the righteous indignation of God. Now, as a theologian, I know that it is very dangerous to suggest a connection between human anger and God's righteous indignation. All kind of mischief can happen with such a connection. There is great danger and great power in saying, what I am angry about, God is angry about. That connection can only be made if it has two abiding characteristics. First, it must be about the destruction of life. Quick or slow does not matter. The point is that life is being taken away, being drained away. There is no doubt that this first characteristic is in place because Black life is constantly stolen life. Only God gives life, and only God can take back life. There's always been the height of hubris and idolatry to think that we can, like God, take life, especially when the taking of that life is to protect property or a particular economic and social order. There is a second characteristic that is necessary if that connection is real. It must be shareable. In fact, it must be shared. I don't think enough people, especially enough Christians, understand that the righteous indignation of God is to be shared. I have had so many dear friends, really dear friends, well-meaning, all of them, call me or text me or email me this week with their condolences, each in their own way saying to me, "I can't imagine what you are feeling right now." Yes, you can. My anger is shareable. Indeed, one of the most stubborn barriers to overcoming this racial world is the refusal of so many people to take hold of Black anger. It is a particular sickness of whiteness that invites people to imagine themselves as spectators of racial suffering and observers of Black pain, who are allowed to feel only assorted forms of white guilt. Those of us who are Christian, we should know better. God wants us to hate what God hates. God invites us into a shared fury, but only the kind that we creatures can handle. You all know that anger is frightening because it is not easily controllable. Anger can easily touch hatred, and if anger enters into hatred, then we will be drawn into violence. And way too many people in this world have been drawn deeply into violence. What Christian faith knows is that the way to keep anger from hatred is not to deny anger, to pretend that it is not real. No, we can't do that. What keeps anger from touching hatred is not the cunning of reason or the power of will. It is simply Jesus. For the Christian, Jesus stands between anger and hatred, prohibiting the reach, blocking the touch, and saying to us, "Don't go there. There is nothing there but death." Anger, bound to God's righteous indignation, has a different purpose for us. It points us to the change that must happen. That is, the overturning of an unjust world order, this racial order.
This segment includes sociologists Samuel Perry and Andrew Whitehead in conversation with Miroslav Volf on Christian nationalism, identity, and violence.
We think Christian nationalist ideology is a powerful influence on Americans' attitudes, but not only their attitudes, their behavior as well, is because Christian nationalist ideology seems to rear its head during times of intense cultural and political conflict. When America is searching for its own identity, when there is instability economically or in times of war and culture, Christian nationalism reemerges as this kind of dominant narrative that has the power to mobilize certain groups of people. And so we think that's what we saw in 2016 and what we feel like politicians are now trying to tap into to try to mobilize Americans to certain ends.
I think, too, when we look historically in times of upheaval throughout U.S. history, we see that as they're searching for what it means to be an American, who are we? Americans continually turn to religion and Christianity, especially, and how that identifies them as a people with a special relationship with God. And so that narrative of being a Christian nation isn't Christian nationalism itself, but it's an important part of it. And so as we look at the Civil War or the Cold War or the New Deal, we see in those times, people moving towards and those in power really highlighting this idea of who we are as a Christian nation and what would the Christian God want for us.
What happens is I think Christian nationalism becomes synonymous in many people's minds with white evangelicalism. Right. And so one of the narratives that we're trying to overturn in our book and to try to push back on is that really the story of religion and say Trump and his brand of politics since 2016 is about white evangelicals. What we find is that once we account for this ideology, this Christian nationalism measure in our studies, being a white evangelical really doesn't matter a whole lot. It really is. It is more of the fact that so many white evangelicals happen to be Christian nationalists. And so to the extent that Christian nationalist ideology is influencing a large swath of conservative Catholics, mainline Protestants, and white evangelicals, yes, it's an absolutely powerful influence on how they are framing debates about immigration, gun control, religious freedom, and Trump himself.
So why are evangelicals particularly susceptible to being white nationalists susceptible, or why predominantly is Christian nationalism an evangelical phenomenon?
I think it has more to do with back 40 years ago in around the time of Reagan. White evangelicals get roped into a culture war that is partly about sexuality, it is partly about race, it is partly about conservative values. And over time, I think studies have shown, and we would confirm that political conservative and religious conservative, and especially conservative Protestant, have become synonymous to where white evangelicals in their own minds, I think, unfortunately, too often conflate those two things, that if I'm going to be theologically conservative and believe certain things about the importance of one's conversion experience with Christ or the authority of the Bible, then I must necessarily hold these politically conservative views and values, and conservative politicians are my only choice. Because any other alternative would be unthinkable. It'd be essentially a denial of my own faith convictions. And so I think white evangelicals especially have become ensnared in that deal with the devil, so to speak, that have given over their political allegiance as they think it's synonymous with their religious allegiance.
Christian nationalism wants to align what it sees as good for the country with positions of power to be able to enforce those things, and it's exclusivist political vision on the United States. And so as it gained access to that, then it doesn't want to lose access to it. And so it will support authoritarian measures. Christian nationalism is a quest for power in the political sphere, in the social sphere. And, at the beginning of our book, we kind of highlighted two quotes, one from Colossians and one from Niebuhr. But this idea from Colossians 2, where Paul's warning them, don't let anybody take you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ. And so when we think of power and the role that power has in this world and whether or not that aligns with the example of Christ, as we see it, or as it kind of is highlighted, that they will take the role of power to enforce rather than another avenue that, for some, looking at Christianity or the aspect of how Christ lived and walked in this world was something completely different.
This is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Marilynne Robinson in conversation with Miroslav Volf on Christianity and democracy.
Can you speak about this kind of Christian nationalism, which many in conservative, evangelical conservative circles want to, in a sense, reclaim America as a Christian nation, and that becomes a certain political project for them. Can you say something about that?
It is true that there are many people that call themselves Christian in this country. If nationalism means taking care of the particular garden you have been placed in, that's fine. If it means hostility or competitiveness toward others, then it's obviously not Christian, you know? Historically, the word Christian is supposed to have meant Christ-like. And it seems to me as if that should always be recognized as an aspiration, not a sociological category. It should also be thought of, I think, as an aspiration that we all fall short of, cannot claim. And I think that there are things that we as Christians should recognize in ourselves and have antibodies toward, things like hatred and resentment and competitiveness that is destructive and making divisions among people that would imply relatively deficient, you know, sacredness or humanity on parts of disfavored groups. I think that any nationalism that claims to be Christian is probably not Christian. As far as democracy itself is concerned, I think that from moment to moment, from person to person, there's a capacity for great insight, for great integrity, and so on. Not in any of us consistently, but overall, if we're attentive to each other, we have those things to learn from each other and to be guided by. There is no other way of trying to tap this potential that exists in human beings other than democracy. We are a radical departure from the order of things in the universe, we human beings. You know, I mean, there are all sorts of marvelous things that exist that have been created, nothing like us. This incredible capacity for creativity and honor and love and all the things that human beings are capable of, that you single them out, you know. I think that we should be able to recognize these things in one another. Even if they're not visible to us, we should know that they're implicit there, you know, in the sacredness of the human being.
Here, political commentator David French comments on political exhaustion, culture war, and the role of faith in political division. Unless you're like establishment left or a Trump supporter, it seems like the norm is now like disillusionment and it's probably some low grade anxiety. And I'm just wondering, like, with the need to find a flourishing life in a United States,
right?
We need that possibility. I wonder if each of you could sort of give like your current mindset on this.
You know, I look out there and I just see a lot of despair and confusion. And, you know, I'm reminded of a survey recently done by the group More in Common, which has really taken this close look at American polarization. And it discovered this group of people it calls the exhausted majority. And this is before the pandemic and before the George Floyd murder. And it was betraying a weariness in approach to American life, just almost like a sense of resignation that things are, especially in this political sphere, are bad and they don't know how to make it better. And then I think the pandemic has only enhanced that feeling. And so it's maybe not necessarily an exhausted majority in the United States as much as there's just a despairing majority in the United States right now. And what is so hard, I think, and this is exactly the point where faith should be breaking through. This is exactly the point where the church, for example, should be sort of raising its banner as, you know, a beacon of compassion and hope. And what's so incredibly unfortunate is that these issues of faith are now so wrapped up in our culture war and the political campaign that it's hard even for faith to break through and provide hope right now. And in many ways, faith provides pain. And so I, you know, as somebody who speaks about these issues a lot, you sometimes feel like you're kind of fighting a two-front war. On the one hand, looking at Americans saying, there is a light in this darkness. And then on the other hand, turning back to the faith community and saying, stop being so fearful and angry as, you know, you confront this modern time.
Yeah, these two last words that you said, fearful and angry, that's what came to my mind as I'm observing the scene. And maybe you're looking at a kind of middle majority. I may be looking at two ends of the spectrum, and there's quite a bit of anger there and hopelessness also that you mentioned. And my question was always, how does I look at the faith itself as this incredible, precious resource, as a jewel, and somehow frustrated that faith that is so life-giving has been hijacked, that it can't speak in its own voice, that it's always refracted in ways that domesticated, that pull it in into the kind of a preset, almost like a herd mentalities. And this instrumentalization of faith is what troubles me and what I'm praying and thinking, how does one break out of that?
There is no significant cultural, political, religious, or social force that is pulling us together more than it's pushing us apart. That we're in the grips of a lot of tidal forces, and politics is only one of them. It's not the only one that is pushing us apart. A huge percentage of us live in these so-called landslide counties where one candidate or another wins by more than 20 points. So we're less likely to be around people of differing minds. The secularization of the United States has not been a phenomenon that's been happening uniformly across all geographic regions. And in fact, there's, in some ways, America is becoming both more secular and more religious, in the sense that the most religious elements of American society are remaining quite strong and sometimes even growing, and also, again, geographically concentrated. I mean, I can go on and on through the various, you know, the subdivision of our media, even down to the subdivision of the entertainment that we watch, so that Americans are really beginning to live quite separate lives. And it isn't a separate life, separate lives that are marked necessarily by all that much affection for the diversity of this country. It's much more marked by a lot of hostility and fear against political opponents. And I'm just, you know, we can never take for granted the continued existence of a continent-sized, multi-ethnic, multi-faith, geographically diverse nation that we can't just take for granted that we can continue to rip at the social fabric and that it will all stay together. And that's so what I'm trying to do in the book is sort of issue a clarion call warning that says, look, we all are aware of polarization, and what we're trying to do as political partisans often is end polarization by the absolute defeat of our opponents. And instead, why can't we deal with polarization by embracing pluralism? And I feel like that's the only way through. I do not think that we have a country where one side or the other can crush and grind the other one into dust. And the very effort to try to do so is only going to fracture us more. You know, if you're in the political discourse in this country, a confession of error is seen not as a sign of humility, or perhaps even not just a sign of humility, but a sign of personal growth, something to be welcomed and applauded. Often a confession of error is seen as a sign of weakness, to be pounced upon and exploited. That if you are, say, on Team Red and you said, you know what, there's something I long thought as part of Team Red that I now know is not right. I don't think that's right. And here's why, and I'm sorry I got it wrong, and I'm going to try to do better. You're immediately seen as a weak figure who is trying to kowtow to people on the other side and worthy of being treated with contempt by people on your, you know, on your team. And it's hard to imagine a culture. And again, a lot of this is amongst the people who are sort of hyper online and hyper engaged in American political culture. It's harder to think of a culture more calculated to discourage humility and discourage expressions of forgiveness than the one that we are creating right now.
A lot of our conversation has been about political or even economic theology. And one of the visions of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture and Miroslav's recent work is the theology that makes a difference. And David, you even recently pointed this out, that all too many Christians, this is a quote, do not possess any form of political theology beyond a commitment to a certain set of issues. You know, you say also, we do not spend nearly enough time learning how to live as political beings. So how do you see political theology making a difference this coming year?
Can I be really pessimistic in response to that?
Yes, you can.
Okay. I think the absence of a political thought theology is going to make a profound difference in this coming year. I think you're going to see an escalating round of fear, escalating fear and anger. I don't see a way through that for right now. And I think that escalating fear and anger is going to be in partly due to this lack of a political theology, a lack of really a lack of understanding the extent to which, you know, God is sovereign over nations. And instead there's a sense that if we through the sweat of our brow right now fail to accomplish what we want to accomplish politically, everything we love will be lost. And which is I believe abdicates, it neglects and ignores the true extent of God's sovereignty over the world and the true extent of God's care and love for his people and for not just his people, but for people, those created in his image. And I feel like we're losing sight of that, and it is raising the temperature of American religious discourse and raising the amount of fear, which quite frankly then compounds a lot of the culture's rejection of faith. Because are you going to look at this incredibly fearful group of human beings, this incredibly angry and fearful group of human beings, and say, oh, they've got this figured out. You know, what, this is the community I want to join. And what you then have is this vicious cycle. It's the fear and anger alienates the church from the culture. And then as the church is alienated from the culture, there's more fear and anger. And you just get into this incredible vicious cycle. And so it's going to be absolutely vital for there to be voices to say, fear not. Do not be angry. Fear not. We can see, you know, I keep going back to that we have to get to a point where we re-embrace Micah 6:8. And Micah 6:8 is, what does the Lord require of you, O man? What is good? It's to seek justice, love mercy, and walk humbly. And seeking justice, that's the part, it's all easy now. That's what you do on Twitter with hashtags, right? And with your political anger. But you also love mercy. You are also merciful to your political opponents. You are kind to them. You love your enemies. You bless those who persecute you. And then you walk humbly. You'll realize, I don't know all the answers. I don't know everything. And until we reconnect with that sort of like three-pronged mission statement, I feel like our fear and anger is going to isolate us more and then cause more fear and anger and more isolation.
This is a segment from my conversation with legal scholar Robert George on the breakdown of civic friendship. We're in a weird year, and we need perspective on how to communicate with each other, how to talk about the strangeness of 2020. We need leaders that are guiding us in wisdom. And you have historically been a key figure and a beacon for civil discourse in this country. I wanted to start with just this week's version of calling out incivility in our public discourse. And it comes from Senator Mitt Romney, where he released something through his Twitter, a statement of sorts about the state of politics in 2020, wherein he says that politics has moved away from spirited debate to a vile, vituperative, hate-filled morass that is unbecoming of any free nation, let alone the birthplace of modern democracy. And so, is of course, people have been saying things like this for years now, that people began to notice incivility years ago, and that was, in fact, the way that we first connected and met. But what do you think about Romney's comment and its accuracy and what it means? Like, what is us reminding the public about incivility? What does it do at this point?
Well, Senator Romney's clearly right in what he says. I don't see how anybody could argue with that. What he's talking about is the breakdown of civic friendship and the indispensable, necessary role that civic friendship plays in the maintenance of Republican institutions. Civic friendship is actually important for all sorts of polities, but for a self-governing people, for a democratic people, civic friendship is really critically important. That's why I say indispensable, necessary. And there's a reason for that. If we fail to treat each other as civic friends, that is to say, as fellow citizens, and instead regard each other as enemies to be defeated and even destroyed, then everything is up for grabs every time there's an election. There's nothing that's stable. The losing side can expect nothing but retaliation. The winning side will have to claim the power to completely control the norms that will govern into the future. And you get a breakdown. There's no question about it. Now, you're right, too, to say that we have heard this before, but that doesn't mean we need to be concerned about it. We have indeed heard it before. We had a serious breakdown of civic friendship very, very near the beginning of this republic, and that is in the period of the late 1700s and early 1800s, especially around the election of 1800, which pitted the incumbent John Adams against Thomas Jefferson. It's a terrible breakdown of civic friendship. The Federalists saw the Democratic Republicans, also known as the Jeffersonians, not as fellow citizens with whom they disagreed, but as enemies to be defeated and destroyed, as enemies of the regime, enemies of the republic, people who wanted to bring the spirit of the French Revolution to the United States. And the Democratic Republicans, the Jeffersonians, felt exactly the same way about the Federalists, that they were not fellow citizens to be disagreed with in an honest democratic debate, and whose rights were to be respected, even if the Jeffersonians prevailed, but rather as enemies of the regime, people who would establish, if they had their way, a British-style monarchy. And that breakdown of trust really threatened the republic right at the beginning. It was not at all clear, certainly wasn't clear to the Jeffersonians, that if the Jeffersonians won, the Federalists would peaceably hand over power, that Adams would leave the White House. That was a genuine concern. And it wasn't at all clear to the Federalists that if the Jeffersonians won, they did, of course, end up winning. It wasn't clear to the Federalists that the Jeffersonians won, that there wouldn't be a reign of terror and revenge against the Federalists. And of course, we saw it then another 50 years later in the run-up to the Civil War and in the war itself, a complete breakdown of civic friendship. Those in the North saw those in the South, and those in the South saw those in the North, not as fellow citizens, to be disagreed with robustly, but nevertheless to be regarded as fellow citizens. They saw each other as enemies, and they could not see how they could live together in a republic. And of course, we know what followed from that. So the fact that it has happened before should give us no comfort. It shouldn't cause us to think, people always complain about the breakdown of civic friendship. They always complain about the lack of civility in politics, but it's no big deal because we always survive. Well, we almost didn't survive in 1800. And I don't need to say anything else about what happened in 1860 and 1861.
I wonder if you'd say a little bit more about what you mean by that friendship, because I think the concept of friendship between especially the extreme left and extreme right in America today does seem implausible. Again, and it's really helpful to be drawn back into other moments in history where there is a form of proof, if not coming with a really significant challenge to the Republic and to individual citizens to work through it. But I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what that friendship would entail, because it seems to me to require, necessitate seeing the other as more than just the sum total of their politics.
Well, that's certainly true. We human beings pride ourselves on being rational creatures, rational animals. Our rationality, we say rightly, is the distinctive thing about us, at least among the terrestrial creatures. But of course, we all know that that we're not just rational. There are other aspects of ourselves. Mm-hmm. We also have emotions. We have feelings. We have passions, to use the old-fashioned term. And that creates complications for us, because as emotional and affective creatures, as creatures with passions, we tend to wrap our emotions more or less tightly around our convictions, including our political convictions. We tend to construct our identities around our beliefs. Now, that's not bad in itself, or just in itself, Evan. In fact, it's good. I mean, we wouldn't want people not to wrap their emotions somewhat tightly around their convictions. We need an emotional investment in what we believe in order to make our beliefs effective, in order to accomplish the things we think are worth accomplishing, whether it's the mundane things of life, getting the kids up in the morning and getting them fed and off to school and getting off to work and so forth, or whether it's acting for the sake of a cause that we regard as especially urgent, just, and noble. So there's nothing wrong in principle with the fact that we wrap our emotions around our convictions. But if we do, as we are prone to do, wrap our emotions too tightly around our convictions, then we become dogmatists. Then we become unwilling to consider the possibility that we might be wrong and that a critic might be right, or at least that we might have something to learn from a critic, even if the critic's not 100% right. We assume a posture of infallibility. Now, of course, if you ask anybody, are you infallible? They're going to say, no, I recognize my own fallibility. Mm. That's one thing, to be able to answer the question correctly, check the right box on an SAT exam. Are you fallible or infallible? But as a practical matter, it's much more difficult, because with our deepest, most cherished identity-forming beliefs, as a practical matter, we tend to think of ourselves as infallible and think of people who disagree with us about those beliefs as bad people. They don't share our deepest beliefs. They're bad people. If they don't share our beliefs on things that we really care about, they're bad people. And because they're bad people, they can't be our friends. Rather, they're our enemies. And since they have beliefs that they are prepared to act on that would establish what we think is wrong or unjust or bad, they are enemies to be not only defeated, but ideally to be destroyed, to be driven out.
And finally, this segment features sociologist Arlie Hochschild.
on building shelters from shame and crossing a bridge to empathy. It really, in order to understand it, you had to move beyond the surface of the story or the surface appearance of inconsistency, right?
That's right. And I had to do something to myself before getting to know them.
Say more.
Yeah, the thing I had to do to myself was relax, take off my moral and political alarm system, and permit myself a great deal of personal curiosity about the humanity of the people with whom I knew I would strongly disagree. And so that's the thing I had to do to myself. Yes. It was a very important experience. It opened up a world to me. It helped me realize what people I didn't know who lived in a different region, different social class, different religious background, how they felt. It was wondrous. It, in a way, as I've come to think of it, created a kind of shame shelter underneath which we could really get to know one another and relate humanly, so that, not so that we agreed, but so that we could disagree in a good way, in a way that did not rupture bonds. Yeah.
That's a very evocative phrase, a shame shelter.
It's just recently occurred to me.
I mean, it's beautiful because it seems like it's to extend to a different metaphor, it's kind of, it just creates a harbor for a relationship, right?
That's right.
Free from the kinds of judgments that need to be made at the level of discussing policy, need to be made at the level of reflection and theory and ideas, but perhaps those judgments don't need to make it so far as just simply being with a person. And so very quickly here, we're like jumping to, and I want to dwell a little bit more on this, how it feels, right? The feelings behind politics, as opposed to merely the ideas behind politics.
Right. I'll give you an example of how it was to jump over what I came to think of as an empathy bridge, that is to cross that bridge, when I encountered people during my 5 years of hanging out and being with people who lived in a different bubble and who lived indeed in a different truth, a different sense of what was true. So a lot of people have a misunderstanding about empathy and active listening. They think of it as weakness. They think of it as giving up in the middle of a war and relinquishing your own attachment to your core beliefs. And this is, of course, completely mistaken. I think, in fact, in order to enact our deepest ideals, we need to develop carefully the capacity not only to deep listen and get where the other person is coming from, but to know when to use it and when not to use it. I think at the moment that we're in, that the feelings I was to discover in my 5 years of work that led to the book Strangers in Their Own Land, things have grown worse and not better.
That we often think that it's political beliefs that separate us, but perhaps it's more the sense of a feeling of belonging and tribe, so that, one's locale really does matter.
Yeah.
Your location and your sort of felt position with people of a similar, geographical location.
Right. And it's not just a geographical location. It's an emotional location. I think we almost live in a shamescape instead of a landscape. And that the people, this is where I'm going in my thinking actually very recently, but draws on this experience of researching for strangers, that what if we were to update what's happened between 2016 when I left the field. But what I think nationally has happened is that Trump has connected with my friends in Louisiana. And he said, I'm for you. You have been in this losing sector. I'm going to make you proud again. Great again. Not just the country, but you great again. And then he's gone farther and said, I suffer for you. You know, this has got almost religious overtones. Not only am I from the top, but I feel like I'm at the bottom. I am suffering for you.
Yeah.
Who does that remind you of? And and I am against enemies, you know, Pharisees. There are those who are not for you, and I am fighting them. So join me in my suffering on your behalf. And then I am sheltering you from the shame they are throwing at you. So here's where I think we are now. Donald Trump, our president, has believes that he has won the 2020 election. He has surrounded himself with this information. He has shut out other sources of information. We can call this a delusion. And he's got his followers joining him in this disbelief that he has lost the election. And they follow him because he is sheltering them from a shame that they have felt unjustly thrust upon them. And Facebook has kind of amplified this. It's just a great big shame machine. If you look at, you know, friending, defriending, it's this kind of a hostile blanket over the nation through this thing called Facebook. And so, anyway, followers, it only amplifies the feelings that followers feel as they identify with Trump. And then liberals see this situation, are appalled by it, and do their shaming. And then they don't see that they are doing their shaming. I thought, oh no, what are you doing here? What what good purpose is served by this counter shaming? It has, I believe, a whole backfire effect. So that is counterproductive. That is, then people are feeling, well, he's being attacked. Our guy, our shelter from shame is being attacked by the shamers. And I think that the liberals, coastal people in cities need to get out of their bubble to get a sense of how their views are received. And once that has happened, then we can create a nation of of shaming shelters within which, under which, we can begin to talk about our differences.
For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured theologian Willie Jennings, sociologists Samuel Perry and Andrew Whitehead, novelist Marilyn Robinson, political commentator David French, legal scholar Robert George, and sociologist Arlie Hochschild. You also heard interview clips from both Miroslav Volf and me. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edited and produced the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. We produce a new episode every Saturday, and you can subscribe through any podcast app. We're grateful that you're listening to this podcast. We're passionate about making this work consistently accessible to people who are genuinely concerned about the viability of faith in a world racked with division, contested views about what it means to be human, and what it means to live life well. If you're in a position to support our show financially, please consider partnering with us. We rely on the generosity of individuals like you to make our work possible. And if you're not, please continue listening and engaging the content. Let us know what you're interested in. We're grateful that you're listening. But if you can give, if you're truly passionate about supporting podcasting that's all about pursuing really living lives that are worthy of our humanity, then consider a gift to the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Visit faith.yale.edu/give. It's our joy to bring these shows to you, and we'd invite you to bring that same joy in supporting this work. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll be back with more next week.